Welcome to the Holistic Survival Show with Jason Hartman. The economic storm brewing around the world is set to spill into all aspects of our lives. Are you prepared? Where are you going to turn for the critical life skills necessary to survive and prosper? The Holistic Survival Show is your family's insurance for a better life. Jason will teach you to think independently, to understand threats, and how to create the ultimate action plan. Sudden change or worst case scenario, you'll be ready. Welcome to Holistic Survival, your key resource for protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Jason Hartman.
Welcome to today's show. This is Jason Hartman, your host, and as you may or may not know, every 10th show we kind of do a special tradition here that originated with my Creating Wealth show, where we do a topic that is actually off-topic on purpose, something just to do with general life and more successful living, and that's exactly what we're going to do today with our special guest. Again, 10th show is off-topic, and it is very much intentional, just for personal and enrichment, and I hope you enjoy today's show. And we will be back with our guest in just a moment. It's my pleasure to welcome Tim Jarvis to the show. He's an Australian adventurer, well, actually I should say Australian Adventurer of the Year, and author of Chasing Shackleton, Recreating the World's Greatest Journey of Survival. And in his amazing journeys that he has done authentically, just as the original explorers had done it, so you'll hear about that. There is a lot to learn about leadership, so that's what we'll be talking about today with Tim Jarvis. Tim, welcome. How are you?
Oh, very good, Jason.
Well, good. It's good to have you. And are you coming to us from Adelaide, Australia today?
No, just to confuse everybody, I'm now in London.
Oh, okay. but that's where you're based, right? Adelaide?
I'm based Adelaide most of the time. That's where I live, with my family. And I spend quite a bit of time in London these days to plan expeditions as much as anything.
Right. Fantastic. Well, tell us a little bit about these amazing journeys and Shackleton and then how we can all be better leaders.
Well, I mean, I think Shackleton managed to save all of his men from disaster on this particular expedition. There were 27 men, including Shackleton, 28. His ship, the Endurance, was crushed in pack ice before he ever reached Antarctica. And the idea was that they sail down in the ship and then be the first people ever to cross Antarctica going from one side to the other. Once that happened, the men had to abandon ship into the three small lifeboats, live on the ice for many months. When the ice broke up, the shifting pack ice, the men got in the boats, paddled them to a nearby island. There, Shackleton left 22 of the 28 men under two of the upturned boats, and then he did this incredible journey across the Southern Ocean in essentially a 22-foot rowboat across the roughest ocean in the world to reach another remote island called South Georgia, where he knew there was a whaling station. He thought, if I can reach that, I can raise the alarm and save everyone.
Now, what is that? What is that roughest ocean? Is that the Cape Horn, or which one is it?
Yes, it's the Southern Ocean, so it's the ocean that goes around the bottom of the world, south of both Cape of Good Hope and Cape Horn. Going, in fact, where we were was very near to Cape Horn. You leave from Elephant Island, just off the Antarctic Peninsula, and the ocean around there is extremely rough. It's the Pacific essentially emptying into the Atlantic, the Southern Atlantic, down around the bottom of South America. It's very, very rough ocean. And look, the fact that Shackleton managed to do it, he managed to save all of his men, was really down to his leadership, his ability to problem solve, change on the run, set goals that everybody could identify with. It gave people confidence that they were actually going to make it, maybe in the face of the facts that suggested otherwise. You know, his ability to understand all of his men and their individual motivations and get them to all pull together as one, by really understanding each of their motivations and get them to all pull together to achieve this single goal, even though their original reasons were all very different. And, you know, a lot of the leadership lessons are so relevant to the issues that we're faced with today in the modern world, whether it's running an organization or issues like climate change or the rise of extremism. All of these issues need to be dealt with collectively and with decent leadership.
Yeah, well, and if you want to make any parallels, Tim, to Shackleton's journey and the success of his leadership and, you know, to something we face in organizations or in the world today, feel free to, you know, make any of those parallels. That's very interesting. So the year again was 1914?
14 is when he set off from the UK to head to Antarctica to do the journey. And then the events actually unfolded over a couple of years, culminating in 1916. We wanted to actually do the expedition before 2014 so that we'd be in a position to really celebrate his achievement on the 100th anniversary of him leaving.
Yeah, yeah. And so is that planned for this year then?
Yes, it is. Yeah, there are all sorts of plans for celebrating his achievement. And it's wonderful to really have done the expedition and not be in the position of being down south, you know, doing it when we could be back here really celebrating his original achievement.
Right, right. So, I mean, tell us about the journey now. You do this in the authentic way, just like the original explorers, without all of the modern conveniences. I mean, you bring cameras and devices to record, but as far as creature comforts and GPS navigation and these other tools, you don't have them, right?
No, that's right. I mean, we traveled in a 23-foot keelless rowboat like Shackleton. The original carpenter on his expedition had taken planks off the other two lifeboats, which is what this boat was, and they built a deck over the boat to stop waves crashing in and sinking them. And so we did the same thing. We traveled wearing cotton outer windproof layers and woolens for our thermal layers and leather boots. We navigated using a sextant, in other words, taking an angle to the sun and working out your position from that. And we ate the same animal fat rations and sledging biscuits as they did on the original. So basically, we did everything exactly the same way as Shackleton.
I mean, that had to be just incredibly difficult. Are you a glutton for punishment, Tim? You know, I mean, it'd be hard enough to do it with all the modern gear and the high-tech tools and the fabrics now that are windproof and warm and, you know, do not collect any moisture. I mean, just...
Yeah, I mean, it was extremely challenging. I mean, we tried to coat the cotton clothing. Of course, the reason Shackleton had worn that clothing is because he'd anticipated walking across Antarctica, which is, in fact, even though it's ice over a mile thick in most places, is very dry. And so he'd never anticipated having to get into a small boat and undertake this incredible rescue mission. And so the clothes were not designed to be waterproof. He tried his best to coat the clothing with animal fat, rendered down from seal blubber. He wiped this onto the cotton clothing to try and waterproof it. And we tried to do the same thing using non-synthetic fat. And of course, the first wave came in on day one of the trip, and everybody was soaked pretty much from that point onwards. You just could not get dry. It was extremely cold. And we were all really always on a path towards hypothermia. We were really having to work hard to prevent that from happening.
How many people on the journey?
Six, just like with him. And that's actually a distinct disadvantage because you're living in the space the size of a queen-size double bed, six men, except you're sleeping on rocks in a dark space just below leaking planks on a rocking wooden boat. It's very, very cold and very uncomfortable and, frankly, very unsafe. But I guess the only advantage of having so many men below deck was that, you know, you couldn't fall very far because you were wedged in so tight like sardines. There wasn't enough room to fall.
Wow, that's just incredible. And how long did this take?
Well, we were out in the ocean for a couple of weeks trying to get from Elephant Island to South Georgia. We had, you know, narrow misses with icebergs and, of course, you know, very big seas, 30, 40-foot waves. And, you know, a couple of close shaves with whales, which were very exhilarating. Humpback whales coming right up alongside, almost brushing the boat. And then we reached South Georgia Island, which is, for listeners who don't know, I mean, this is a 600-foot high cliffs. And you have a following sea, which is basically trying to throw you onto those cliffs and onto those rocks. And you have to basically try and thread the needle and get into the bay that Shackleton did. One thing's for sure, you're going ashore, regardless of what you try and do, because you can't turn and sail away with that sea pushing you forwards when you're in a boat with no keel.
Wow, it's just amazing. I mean, what do you think about these now a couple of ships are now caught in the ice down there. The first it was one, and then there was a rescue ship, and now the rescue ship got caught. Of course you've heard this news story that's been unfolding the last, I don't know, week and a half or so. Just crazy. And now the US Coast Guard is down there, and I don't know the latest.
Yes, that's right. I mean, the ship that's stuck is a Russian vessel, and the Australian government, the Australian Antarctic Division, hired it to take these people south. It's a combination of scientists and tourists, and they got stuck in pack ice. Then the Chinese tried to rescue them in an icebreaker, albeit not a very powerful one. And then the Australian government sent Aurora Australis, which is a more powerful icebreaker that I've travelled on a number of times, to exactly that place, in fact. And they too couldn't get through and were almost stuck. And I think now we have a situation where the US Coast Guard are sending a more powerful icebreaker down to try and help out all the others. Look, the deal is that if the wind is blowing offshore in Antarctica, which often it is, a lot of the ice that would otherwise be rucked up against the coast of Antarctica is spread out over vast expanses of ocean. But if the wind is blowing onshore, all of those icebergs and pack ice that would otherwise be out to sea effectively ends up in a kind of 30, 40-mile thick buffer all round the coast of Antarctica, and that's what they're stuck in. It's really luck of the draw as to whether or not you get stuck in that or not. But I guess because they have tourists on board, they'd be really intent on trying to reach Mawson's Hut at Commonwealth Bay, which is where they're trying to get to, just to show them Antarctica and let people jump off and touch terra firma. And maybe that pressure to try and do that that's forced them into the position they're in when they perhaps should have thought about staying offshore a bit longer.
That's amazing. I mean, I guess it's summer there now, right? I mean, that's the complete opposite. So they're right in the middle of summer.
Yeah, right in the middle of summer, and still, in the interior of Antarctica, summer means minus 40 Fahrenheit, maybe lower, minus 50, minus 60. But in the depths of winter, of course, you have 24-hour darkness, and the temperatures go far lower than that. So summer is a relative term. It means
Right. They thought the ice would be a lot less significant, though, I guess, this time of year, and apparently, it's unexpected cold and ice, right?
Yeah, I think, like I say, it's a combination of the cold and the fact that the wind is blowing a lot of the pack ice into shore and forming this great barrier. If it was blowing the other direction, you'd probably find that pack ice, regardless of how cold it was, would just break up and you'd be able to get in quite easily, relatively. So there's a bit of luck, a bit of judgment involved in their predicament, I think.
Well, tell us more about your journeys and leadership and Shackleton, et cetera. I didn't want to divert you too much with that tangent, but I just thought it was it's rather amazing what's going on down there.
Yes, it is. And look, I always use my journeys as an opportunity to talk about leadership lessons and also sustainability issues. I mean, I'm an environmental scientist by training, and I think it's fair to say that people wouldn't really listen to what I had to say based on my environmental science background. But if you combine that with an interest in the polar regions and you talk about the melting ice caps and melting glaciers and that sort of thing, then people tend to listen.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much controversy about that. Why is there so much controversy about this stuff? I mean, is there more ice or less ice, and what's happening
Yeah.
there?
In fact, the picture is not that difficult. It's just that there's a lot of misinformation. There are, of course, you're dealing with very complex systems that are very large. That's the first thing. But there is a lot of misinformation. Now, there are a lot of vested interests in whose interest it is to confuse people and
On both sides, though, because on
actually.
the Al Gore side of the aisle, that a lot of this climate change stuff, or really it was called global warming, but the name was changed to climate change. It was all global warming. That's all we used to hear. Now we hear climate change, and the people on that side of the aisle claim, hey, this is just an excuse for governments to control us and to raise prices and deny us resources and things like that. And then, of course, on the global warming side, we know what they say. They say the caps are melting, and we got to do something about it. And what is your take?
Well, in the case of the Antarctic, because this is a big topic, in the case of the Antarctic, Antarctica is about twice the size of the lower 48. It's a very big piece of real estate. The average thickness of ice there is over a mile thick. That's the average thickness. So 97% of the world's water is in the ocean, and of the remaining 3%, 2% is actually locked up in the Antarctic ice cap alone. But that ice cap is divided into two. 90% of it is in what you call the Eastern Antarctic ice cap, and that's the majority of Antarctica. The rest is in the Western Antarctic ice cap, which is the left-hand bit if you're looking at the map with the US at the top or Europe at the top. And that bit, the western bit, is melting quite quickly. We really are experiencing a lot of warming down there. We've got about 40 bases, all of whom have been there since the mid to late 1950s onwards. The US, the Germans, the Brits, the Argentinians, the Chileans, you know, a whole range, the French. And all of them have recorded the same thing, that we've experienced about 4 degrees Fahrenheit of warming in the last 50 or 60 years down there, which is completely, unquestionably, way beyond anything that the natural environment would produce on its own. So on the western part of Antarctica, we're seeing a lot of melting. The eastern part, which is the majority, as I've said, we're in a situation where there's more melting happening at the edges of Antarctica around the coast, where the temperature is now going above zero quite a lot, zero Celsius. And we're seeing a lot of the glaciers carving ice. In other words, ice is pouring into the ocean from those glaciers because the glaciers are moving more quickly, because a lot of the time melting is lubricating the bases of the glaciers and they're just carving off ice faster. But that's being offset by more snow in the interior because of higher evaporation rates from the ocean. In other words, more heat means that more moisture gets sucked out of the ocean and dumped on Antarctica as snow. So the short answer, majority of Antarctica is in a kind of state of uneasy equilibrium. That's the eastern bit. The western bit is melting very fast because of warmer temperatures. So the answer is both sides of the argument are kind of right. Eastern part is kind of stable. Western part, which alone contains enough ice to raise global sea levels by many meters on its own, is unfortunately melting quite fast.
So here's one of the things I've just never understood about this argument. I frequently have a glass of water and I put ice in the water. And when the ice melts, the glass does not overflow. And we hear Al Gore out there saying that the ocean levels will rise as the ice melts. But even if the ice completely melts, only 3% of it is on land, based on what you just said, right? So could this ocean rising theory really occur?
Yes, it could. I mean, what you're describing is absolutely right. If anybody you know, has a glass of water with ice cubes in it and the ice cubes melt, you won't see any difference in the level of water in the glass, because the ice is already displacing the equivalent volume of water, so that when it melts, it won't make any difference to the level. The issue is that in Antarctica, that ice is not in the ocean currently. It's on the land.
Right, but it's only 3% of the world's ice is on land, right?
No, it's 3% of the world's water is in the 2% of the world's water is in the Antarctic ice cap.
Okay, so 2% of... So that would cause a... If it all melted, if it 100% of it melted, which would be, you know, amazing, right? Then we'd have 2% more water in the ocean, right? Is that the...
Yeah, we'd have, if the whole lot melted, we'd have about 230 feet of sea level rise just from the Antarctic cap alone. Because, of course, you've got to appreciate that the ocean, even a shallow ocean like the Arctic Ocean, is average depth is about 6,500 to 7,000 feet. That's the Arctic Ocean. That's a shallow ocean. Many of the other oceans are far, far deeper. And so,
right,
you
but
know,
it doesn't,
you
it doesn't matter how deep the ocean is, right? That's not really what we're talking about. We're talking about the ice that's on the land coming into the ocean as water.
Yes.
That's the discussion, right?
That's absolutely right. But
yeah,
I'm just
so who cares how deep the, I mean, right? Or I don't know, you know, tell me, what does that make
sense? I'm just trying to give an idea that, you know, it only takes a small amount of additional water supply to the ocean to actually raise the levels quite significantly.
Oh, okay. Because in other words, that represents, in our example, the size of the glass. So,
yeah, that's it.
But a 2%, if that ice came into the ocean, do we have oceanfront land in Phoenix, or do we have the sea levels rise by an inch worldwide? You know, there's a lot that's got to cover, you know, 75, that 2% of ice. would have to come into what covers already 75% of the Earth. It is covered in water. So I don't know. Can it be that significant?
Yeah. Yes, I mean, it is. You know, the difficulty is that, I mean, there are a whole bunch of things going on here. But for a start, you know, if you just, ocean levels don't just rise like water in a bath where everything rises an equal amount over the course of the whole planet. Because, of course, you have tides, you have the moon causing those tides, and then you have the positions of the continents. And so you can end up in a situation where, you know, in some places sea level rise is far more significant than in others just because of the positions of the continents and the time it takes for the water to actually reposition itself over the whole of the planet. So it's not an equal rise across the whole thing. That's a very sort of key point, I suppose, to grasp. The second thing is that really we don't need to talk about, you know, Al Gore's, in fact, I don't even know what his figures are. I have met him and he seems, you know, a very, very decent guy, very well informed and, you know, very passionate. But I'm really concerned about places like, for example, Asia, where I live. I live in Australia, and by 2050, we will have 4 billion of the 9 billion people that we're likely to have on the planet living in Asia. And many of those cities are within, you know, a meter, so 3 feet of, you know, high tide mark. Places like Jakarta, places like Beijing and Shanghai, places like, you know, Singapore, Sydney, you know, huge quantities of the world's population will live in these coastal zones that will be impacted by much, much smaller amounts of sea level rise than the kind of the disaster scenarios we hear about in Al Gore's predictions.
Yeah, I mean, Al Gore is saying things like we'll see a 30-foot increase in ocean levels and sea levels. So, you know, the coastline, that water will come up 30 feet. I mean, that's unbelievable.
Yes, I don't think that's correct. But what I would say is, I work for an engineering firm and I'm an environmental scientist and I deal with a lot of industry people and I'm a pragmatist. I don't, I work with people rather than against them. But, you know, things like, you know, salt water, you float a lot better in salt water than you do in fresh water, and that's because it's much more dense. And, you know, in the case of Australia, a lot of the aquifers, the groundwater that supply the drinking water for Australian cities, and just about all Australian cities are on the coast because it's so dry and hot in the interior. You know, we end up in a situation now where already we're starting to see salt water contaminating a lot of the fresh water that lies below our cities because the sea level is just rising subtly and enough for salt water to get into our freshwater drinking supplies. Because it's heavier, salt water sinks and it goes and contaminates the whole of the groundwater supply. And that just becomes a big social cost. You know, it's a big economic and social cost. It's not waves lapping up against the main football stadium or the town hall in the center of town. It's far more subtle effects that are going to cause the problems. And in the case of Asia, a lot of farming land is becoming contaminated by gradual rising of salt. And this is causing people to need to move.
Are there any benefits to global warming? I mean, you know, let's just try to be really objective for a moment. Like, you know, for example, land that is not arable now, if the earth gets warmer, will more people be able to grow crops and you know, will that lessen starvation in some areas because it gets a little warmer?
Well, look, I would say there are bound to be some benefits. It's a case of the places where I think a lot of these changes are going to occur are places where people are not really easily adaptable. I mean, if you want to take, for example, I've heard it suggested that, you know, warming will actually help the tundra in Russia, for example. I mean, the problem there is, of course, that the soils have developed based on the vegetation that they've had over, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. And that vegetation has always been pretty low level vegetation, poor quality vegetation based on the climate. And so it takes a long, long time for a decent enough soil to build up to actually take advantage of the warmer temperatures to actually grow a decent crop in a place like that. Because, you know, you just haven't had the right biology there to enable that to happen. You get things like disease spread, of course, with warming. And of course, you get more extreme weather events. And in fact, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, who are much maligned a lot of the time, probably very unreasonably, because they are a very high caliber group of scientific advisors, have suggested that we're going to see some of the worst excesses of extreme weather events and things like that in the tropical regions, not in the not in necessarily in the polar regions or in the more temperate zones, but in the tropical regions. And a lot of those places are where we have developing countries that are perhaps less capable of handling extreme weather events, you know, at either end of the scale.
Yeah, interesting. It just seems so hard to pin down and so, you know, so difficult to actually quantify any of this stuff. I mean, to say that the climate change, right? Well, I mean, the climate has always changed. The Earth has gone through huge shifts throughout history, hasn't it? I mean, this is just so, it's so subjective. I don't know. I just can't.
It is very difficult to grasp. And of course, I think the key thing in all of this is that humans are quite adaptable creatures, but they can only adapt at a certain pace. And I think what the climate change that we're starting to see, whether it's for good or bad, and I suggest that most of the effects will probably be, unfortunately, adverse, you know, people just don't, you know, society doesn't have the capacity to change as quickly as it will need to cope with the change that's coming. I mean, certainly in Australia, I'm always very wary of citing the recent spate of terrible kind of fires we've had and terrible extreme rainfall events we've had in the different parts of the country you know, attributing them to climate change. But certainly even a developed country like Australia has had some really awful conditions in the last 10 to 15 years that even it struggles to deal with. We've had hundreds of deaths in fires recently in Australia, which is, you know, really quite something. We've really not had problems on that scale before, and I would really wonder how a developing country could handle the kind of conditions we've had recently.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a really interesting topic. All throughout history, Tim, I mean, you know, there's a really interesting article that a lot of motivational speakers use from the 1800s, and it's from the Boston Globe, and it was the front page headline, and it says, "World to go dark, whale blubber scarce," you know, and it's like we keep solving these problems. Granted, there are externalities. I mean, I know that, you know, certainly increased commerce and growing economies, they create external problems. But it just kind of seems like we, you know, I mean, you can't be cavalier about this stuff. And I completely agree with you there. We always come up with something. I mean, species have always gone extinct throughout history. You know, the dinosaurs aren't here with us today, you know. So I guess the first issue is, how much of this is man doing it? You know, and then the second issue is it bad? Okay, which, you know, you've brought up some good points about it. And, you know, there are a lot of layers. You really got to peel a lot of stuff on this onion here to have a rational discussion about it. And people on both sides are very passionate. But, you know, I mean, I guess the problem really boils down to population, right? Is that the big issue?
Well, I think it's a combination. I think really, unfortunately, the Western lifestyle that is the US and Canada and Europe and Australia and New Zealand and South Africa and maybe Brazil and a couple of other countries, you know, everybody wants that lifestyle. And if we all have it, we are really massively over-consuming versus the capacity of the planet to supply what we need. I mean, the total amount of land that we have appropriated from nature, if you like, in other words, and I'm including, you know, forest land and pasture and, you know, land under wheat and that sort of thing, through to our cities and through to the coastal zones in which we do most of our fishing, the continental shelves of many of our continents. We've got about 14 billion acres of land. 14 billion hectares of land. And we are...
What is that measurement, that 14 billion hectares?
14 billion hectares is the land that we've kind of taken from nature to convert to some sort of human end use, whether it's city, you know, recreational areas, agriculture, whatever. You know, it's land that's no longer native vegetation, forest, and that sort of stuff. And where there are 7 billion of us. So we've essentially got about two, what they call global hectares each. So two areas of 10,000 square meters each, in which to, you know, two 300 by 300 foot squares each to derive everything we need throughout the whole of our life. You know, our education, our laptop computers, our iPhones, our food, you know, our cars, everything we need. On average, we have 2 hectares each from which to get that, if you want to look at it in those terms. And as the population increases, the amount of physical land we have to get what we need, to give us everything we need throughout our lives, is obviously going to go down because we are now over 7 billion. Predictions are we will be at 9 by 2050, and by 2100 we could be at 10 to 10.5 billion. But another function of it is how much we consume. And if we all lived like, you know, Bangladeshis, there'd be enough space on the planet for 30 billion of us. Now, I'm not suggesting we go and do that, but the problem is that many Bangladeshis want to live like Americans or Western Europeans or Australians. You know, they want to have a car and a half and a big piece of land and maybe a small boat to go out in, and they want to eat meat and they want to eat sugar. And you know, those things, there's not enough space or resources for us all to live in that way. So whereas we've always got away with coming up with the techno fix in the past, I suspect the physical carrying capacity of the planet is beginning to be really seriously compromised now.
Right. But so let's just talk about that agriculture thing. And by the way, I know we're running a little long, so if you have to go, just let me know anytime.
I do have to go in a minute.
Okay, yeah. All right. But on that agriculture thing, I mean, certainly with, like, you see this amazing stuff, and I've interviewed people about the concept of urban gardening before on my shows. Amazing! And agricultural land has become so much more efficient with modern technology. I mean, what used to take an acre to produce, you can do that now in a tiny little space. It's unbelievable what they've done with modern agricultural technology, and I suppose that's only going to get better. So the disclaimer has to be, in all fairness, is under present technology, and you know, none of us know what will come, what will be discovered in the future. I mean, did anybody think we would have 3D printing 100 years ago? I mean, that's going to be an amazing boon.
I think it all comes down to a case of, do we want to try and safeguard the future based on what we currently know, and what we currently know to be the wrong thing to do, or do we not? I mean, there is another term that says, you know, in the case of, say, fossil fuels, the Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of rocks. You know, we just moved on to a new technology. And so it is fossil fuels. We don't need to use absolutely everything up before we decide that alternatives are perhaps less impactful. I mean, I think we realize that particulates are not good for our health. I think we realize that clearing land is not good for us in terms of, you know, exploiting potential pharmaceutical gains that might be made from, say, rainforest environments. We know that the health of the planet is reliant upon a lot of recycling of the waste that we generate by natural processes. You know, trees take in you know, CO2 and give out oxygen. We rely on a lot of natural environments to filter a lot of the waste material we put into them. So, you know, certain things we know to be bad that we should be doing something about, regardless of whether or not we you know, feel, you know, that climate change is a real phenomenon or not. There are a lot of win-wins that can be gained from, you know, not appropriating more land from the natural world than we actually need. In terms of things like urban farming, I mean, I work for a company called Arup, and we design a lot of these kind of, we've designed a vertical farm for Singapore, which is a tower which actually grows things, as the name implies, vertically, and takes up far less space. And it's a great initiative. One would have to do that on an absolutely massive scale for it to really be impactful. But we do have things to learn from very unlikely places, places like Shanghai. The Chinese are often criticized for their lack of environmental awareness, but, you know, cities like Shanghai, they derive 60% of their dairy produce, about 75% of their meat, and about 80% of their vegetables from within the city limits of that city through agriculture. So we have a lot to learn from them in certain respects. And so, look, I think it's just a case of, you know, understanding that certain activities we're involved in do not represent the future. I think mass fossil fuel burning for our principal energy requirements are not the way to go in the form of coal and oil. But it's a case of just you know, getting a change on a sufficient scale to make a real impact.
Yeah, definitely. Well, this has been a very interesting discussion. Your website is timjarvis.org, and that's .org, not .com, so timjarvis.org. Are there any other websites or resources you'd like to give out, Tim?
Well, shackletonepic.com, of course, is the Shackleton Expedition website. And That's a great one to find out a bit more about what we were doing on the Shackleton expedition and about some of the change we saw down there and some of the leadership lessons that I think Shackleton stood for.
Fantastic. Well, Tim Jarvis, thank you so much for joining us today.
Fantastic. Really enjoyed it.
What's great about the shows you'll find on jasonhartman.com is that if you want to learn about some cool new investor software, there's a show for that. If you want to learn why Rome fell, Hitler rose, and Enron failed, there's a show for that. If you want to know about property evaluation technology on the iPhone, there's a show for that. And if you'd like to know how to make millions with mobile homes, there's even a show for that. Yep, there's a show for just about anything. Only from jasonhartman.com. Or type in Jason Hartman in the iTunes store.
Thank you for joining us today for the Holistic Survival Show, protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Be sure to listen to our Creating Wealth show, which focuses on exploiting the financial and wealth creation opportunities in today's economy. Learn more at www.jasonhartman.com or search Jason Hartman on iTunes. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, offering very general guidelines and information. Opinions of guests are their own, and none of the content should be considered individual advice. If you require personalized advice, please consult an appropriate professional. Information deemed reliable, but not guaranteed.